You're listening to Visionaries by Wonder, a podcast where CEOs, founders, and leaders share their success stories with their host, Jeannie O, the founder of Wonder and an award-winning product strategy and UX design firm. We'll be exploring the world and connecting with inspiring individuals. Join us.
Today on Visionaries, we are thrilled to have Rahul Khatri, co-founder and chief experience officer of Stoggles. Rahul's company has taken the eyewear industry by storm by creating stylish safety glasses that are not only durable, but also lightweight, making them suitable for everyday wear. The company raised $40 million from the Turning Group to expand its product offerings and reach new markets. He has worked with some of the biggest names in the industry, bringing award-winning products to market and driving value for people and businesses. Rahul's ultimate goal is to apply design thinking principles to organizations worldwide and inspire others to explore new insights that create a positive and promising future. So join us today as we dive into Rahul's journey as a designer and entrepreneur and learn more about the exciting developments in the eyewear industry. So Rahul, welcome to the show.
Awesome. Thanks, Jeannie. That was a really, really awesome introduction. I've never had anybody give that sort of introduction for me. So I appreciate it. I'll remember this one for sure. It's an awesome pleasure to be here. Excited to share my story.
Like safety glasses, how did you get into that?
I never had that on the list when I came here out here to Pasadena to study design. I did my sort of master's in industrial design from Art Center College of Design, which is up in Pasadena. And eyewear was never on the radar. Forget safety eyewear. A classmate who had, during the last term of his time at Art Center, created a really nifty pair of sunglasses that sort of fold up and go into your pocket. Ooh. And they were super high-end, didn't have any screws, really revolutionary. I mean, this is why you go to good school, to like meet people with just really cool ideas. And he had just finished running a successful Kickstarter, and I was just doing some consulting work on the side, usually between a lot of graphic work and UI, UX, and making presentations. And he reached out to me and said, hey, I know you have a lot of experience, you know, running sort of startups and helping businesses get up and running. Do you mind helping me for 3 months? And that's how sort of this, my sort of interest in eyewear sort of took off. And yeah, that was the sort of the first company we worked on for about 3 years before Stoggles took off in 2020, which is where I found myself or ourselves in.
Wow. So you started a company in the midst of COVID.
Yes, exactly. Very, very interesting circumstances for sure. Yeah, like I was mentioning, the company that, you know, my business partner started was called Rove Eyewear. And during the pandemic, I think it was the first couple of months during the pandemic, we found it almost impossible to sell high-end, cool sunglasses. I remember at the time, Dr. Fauci saying that, hey, you could get COVID through the eyes. And so we thought, you know, hey, maybe this is an interesting opportunity for us to bring some attention to us. To this cool brand that's doing sunglasses, but given the times we're in, we wanted to stay relevant, and here was our push to making safety cool. And since we were designers, we were like, yeah, we could do a better version of safety glasses. I mean, you know, it's such a mundane industry already that's driven highly by price-sensitive customers. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of opportunity right out of the gate to like just make it better. And so that was the initial intention behind how Stoggles came to be.
That is such a cool founder story, because when I first heard about Stoggles, I was just like, oh, like safety glasses for manufacturing companies, right? Yes. Like, I mean, because my dad worked in engineering, and so he wore these like chunky safety glasses. So that's literally where my head initially went to. I didn't realize that there's a catch between like making safety cool for COVID and what what you've built. That's pretty awesome.
Initially, it was just to like, you know, sell it to a customer that was sort of COVID, you know, aware and was wanting to take that extra step of protection to like make them feel feel secure, but also at the same time, like fashionable, so you didn't feel like you were wearing like a 3M mask with these like really clunky safety goggles like your dad would wear. I was the initial customer, but as soon as we ran our Kick crowdfunding campaign, we realized that most of the customers that were actually coming to us, which, I mean, it just blew up in our mind, were actually healthcare customers. And then sort of we retraced our steps back to understand, like, why was this customer never on our radar? Like, that was not the intent. And it turned out that healthcare was like the community that was underserved, especially in safety glasses. Most of the people that wore safety glasses in within those environments were essentially women. Mm-hmm. And largely, like, safety glasses were all designed around men. So no one had ever considered someone like, you know, that was going to wear it and like wear it throughout the day and wanted to look great and feel, you know, the functional and get like the sort of the functional aspects out of the pair of glasses. And so it went off like a light bulb in our head, and we're like, oh my God, we've just like found a community that is so excited about this product. And you know, now thinking about it, or even back then, we realized that there were cool companies like Figs that had taken scrubs and had done the same sort of thing by like making it really consumer friendly, really elevated the sort of experience for the customer, make them feel special by, you know, introducing all these different colors. And sort of we followed that same model, you know, that fixed it just with protective eyewear. Overnight, we became like a healthcare brand, you know, that was nurses and doctors just have great safety eyewear and also look good, because we knew that the best way to come to this was introduce it with a whole bunch of colors to match the figs.
Yeah, and I'm sure there was a ripple effect of like one person wearing your safety glasses and it's like, well, that actually looks cool and not chunky and ugly, and then they're telling it to everybody else that they're working with. That's amazing. So do you ever target outside of the healthcare industry, or is that kind of the niche that you're staying with at the moment?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think during COVID, I think that was our, you know, major sort of customer. They got the product, they enjoyed the product, they spoke about the product. So initially, it was definitely that was our sort of a go-to-market strategy, our customer that we really wanted to serve. And much of 2021 and 2022 was sort of positioned towards that customer. But I think what ended up happening in like early to mid 2022 was that we just got COVID fatigue, and we felt it even in our sort of our sales dipping. We would talk to nurses and they were like, oh my God, we're so glad to hear that masks and eyewear like mandates are going to be lifted. And so we were like, why are we trying to like force something, you know, as like a product to a category of customers that is sort of in this moment where they need it, and maybe it's mandated, but not for everybody. So, and then we realized that there were all these other facets of safety eyewear. And because we had success serving this customer, that we would be able to find success in other facets of the market, which would be like construction, or like DIY is a big one for us today. You know, people who build furniture or do painting that sort of adopt our product today. And so now I think we're taking on a mode of like education. We're just trying to be the best safety eyewear for anybody and everybody that needs it, while still serving, you know, our loyal customers in healthcare who still, you know, love our product and wear it very, you know, professionally.
Sure, of course. And it's almost like you're in this founder's dilemma of, you already have a customer base. Now, do you change your product offering, or do you change the target market altogether? And you're kind of like straddling right in between the two.
Yeah, exactly. You said it right. That was what we were sort of facing, where initially we were like, we would show our goggles only with people wearing scrubs, you know? So it fit that sort of demographic, that customer. They saw it as a way of, you know, coupling our products with the products they already had and that they were using. But today we're taking on, like I said, this mode of education. We're just trying to go at it with all different places by being like a beacon of information around safety eyewear, because it's been a dull topic. Let's be honest, you know, it's not the most exciting topic around safety eyewear. And even when, as a designer, I was like, yeah, you know, it's not the, you know, most fun topic to chat about. But when you like roll back, the carpet a little bit and you start to like unveil certain things, you understand that 2 million people have eye injuries in a year in the US alone. 80% of those happen at home. So clearly, like, we're doing something right where it's not front of mind for us. And because the products and the offerings that are on the market today don't, you know, create a great experience, we're almost like, you know, rejecting or like rebelling against something that is actually going to help us stay protected. And so what we've done is just tried to make that experience better, A, through sort of the product at the product level, and B, at the brand level. And then I think, you know, you go further and just making it be about the customer. And so because we're D2C and we're not like a big conglomerate like 3M is, or, you know, we're able to be a lot more lean, change our story, appeal to a lot broader audience, just because we're coming at it from a very different space rather than, you know, your employer buying it for you and forcing it on you. We essentially created something that people didn't have to wear, but people wanted to wear.
Sure, of course. It sounds like your vision is to make safety more fun and more stylish.
Yeah, exactly. Just give safety a new look, I think. And that's why I think it comes down to the name Stoggles. Initially, it was a permutation of like joining two words. So we took stylish and goggles. And it became
That's a great name.
It was a fantastic name. And I thought, you know, when we heard it, it wasn't so by us, but one of our friends. You know, when we heard that, we instantly connected with it. And we felt like this was a name.
Yeah. Of course. I mean, and you brought up an interesting fact that 2 million people a year are getting eye injuries. You know, I wonder how many of those are from popping champagnes and just going straight to the eye.
Yeah, all that. If we can start to do it and make it, you know, stylishly cool, and it's not seen as this thing that is like, ooh, you got safety eyewear on, you know, then it becomes more normal.
Let's dive into a little bit more about like what are the biggest challenges you've faced so far as a startup founder, and like how did you overcome them?
Wow, that's a brilliant question. I mean, I can start with design because I think that's where, you know, as designers, we're sort of like our whole thing is that we want a challenge. You know, it's like a game. You don't want a game that's too easy because then the challenge is too easy. And there's no reward, but you don't want something that's super difficult either. And I think the biggest challenges we faced early on was just, it was just both of us. And we just wanted to make a product that was gonna just work as like a MVP. We know that there's a standard that we want to achieve, and we won't stop at anything at like achieving that standard. And sure, it's important to reach that standard, but the timing of it is crucial. And so when you lock yourselves into like a sprint sort of mentality, which we worked on when we did consultancy, you know, work for a whole bunch of different clients because they wanted things fast and it was like really hard. So we used the sprint model that, you know, Google came up with and sort of tried to work quickly to try and achieve a standard that we felt was acceptable. And I think in the early years or the early months of Stoggles, I think that was the biggest challenge was like, can we just be lean and fast? Thankfully, because of COVID, you're locked in sort of like a boot camp into like a, you know, like a vacuum. What that enables you to do, which Art Center did too, because you're like, you know, vacuumed into this place, is that it allows you to just focus on one thing.
Yeah.
And that's it. You wake up and you go back to it. And I think today, if I had to like, you know, fast forward, that's a challenge today where we're not sucked into this vacuum. So how do you create that vacuum where you're still able to take leaps in like in your strides and not move at a pace that's comfortable? The other thing I would say is that to try different things. I mean, if Rove didn't do badly because of a pandemic, you know, because nobody was interested in buying sunglasses, it forced us to make that leap into safety eyewear, which otherwise we would have never done. We would have gotten complacent and been like, listen, we signed up for Rove Eyewear. This is our baby. We're going to have to see this thing through. Sort of like you curbs the opportunity where you're able to like switch a gear and do something totally different that's going to bring on so much more value to people. And we don't have any regrets about that.
Absolutely. I have so many follow-up questions from just the two things that you've mentioned. So for one, you know, what you just mentioned is, man, I can't remember what the phrase is, but it's like you have a frog and you put the frog in boiling water. It's going to jump right out of it because it's uncomfortable. But if you put a frog in regular temperature water and then just minute by minute, dial up the heat, it's going to withstand the boiling water. And that's exactly what you were saying with Rove. Like, you would have just kind of turned the heat up just a little bit more. But because of COVID, you jumped out, you jumped ships to a completely different opportunity. And I think that's the dilemma so many people are stuck in, whether it's in personal relationships or with their jobs or whatever it is in their lives. It's like they're comfortable. It's uncomfortable, but comfortable enough where they just keep going at it. And it's until you have something that's so catastrophic that that's going to force you to do something different with your life.
Oh, 100%. I think we're like, as humans, we habituation. And I think co-founder of Nest, he worked for Apple. He said it beautifully. We have habituation is such a powerful thing for us because in some ways we love habituation. So we don't have to learn something every time we have to do it. I mean, can you imagine if we have to do that with driving? We'd have accidents every day. Certain things, it's like sort of a negative because, like you said, it gets into that comfortable but not uncomfortable enough to make a change. And I think that's like, I think as human beings, we're always gonna have to fight that.
Yeah, and we have to just have conscious awareness all the time about why we're doing certain things. Is it just because we don't want to get out of our comfort zone, or is it because we actually enjoy what we're doing? And I don't know, I think a lot of people are stuck in that hamster wheel of like comfort, discomfort.
Yeah, because the fear of using what you already have. And like, you know, I think loads of people tell us like, be grateful for what you have. I mean, that's good and bad, because I feel like if you're only grateful, then you'll never like feel like this urge to wanting more. But you know, in one sense, it'd be like, oh my God, you're always wanting more. So how do we keep you grateful?
100%. And, you know, not to get super philosophical here, but like my whole thing is, you know, you could, for me, the gratitude comes from choices that you make, right? So if my choice is that I want to start a D2C brand and that was my end goal, then every suffering, every whatever it is that I'm doing, I'm going to be grateful because this is the end point. This is the choice I've made. However, it's hard to be grateful for something that you feel like you haven't chosen. So if you're just going to a job that you don't even like, then it's very difficult to be grateful for that, even though you're suffering less than having your own startup, because you're like, I know the
absolutely angle. Right. And I'm fortunate that I'm able to make those decisions. Being an immigrant in this country, that's even harder, you know. For people to invest and like have faith in what you bring to the table and know that you're part of the team, it's huge. And I think that's what anybody strives for. So glad to be here.
Yeah, especially because you have family expectations.
That layers another like fold on top. But I think after a while, it's just your expectations and like what makes you happy that drives you. And if I think you can find that place, then things work. But
But I want to go back to the other point that you made, which I think is so good, which is giving yourself a vacuum to work on something. And also being able to say, this is my standard, but we also have a time limit. So let's just ship out something that's viable and go and test it out. Because I think this is where so many entrepreneurs and founders fail, is they're trying to strive for perfection that they lose so much time and resources to get to that perfection, and they never end up shipping something. And by the time they ship, nobody actually wants it because they haven't done any testing to get there.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely. I heard a great analogy that said it's kind of like a marathon runner. They are hyper-focused if they're working towards a marathon, that they work backwards to like putting themselves in a vacuum where they prepare for that marathon. And so I think if you see it like that, then you're preparing for this one big day that you launch something, and you're only going to be able to like, And obviously set a realistic date, which obviously the marathon runner here cannot push forward, right? And so for us as well, it was like, that's the date we want to launch, because anything further than that, we landed ourselves into a whole bunch of other issues. So how do we vacuum ourselves? And thankfully, COVID did that for us.
Yeah, of course. So what advice do you have for someone who wants to start a new company, or even for your team? Let's say you have... You're launching a new product line, for instance. How do you then create a vacuum without COVID when you're just living an everyday normal life?
Yeah, that's a great question and something that we're trying to sort of instill as we during this year. And one thing that I think we're both excited for is like having a whole bunch of sessions where you get to brainstorm and collaborate and you force people to come. I mean, it's hard because, you know, for a long time it's been remote, but thankfully our creative team, you know, is able to come in 2 to 3 days a week. And so those 2 to 3 days, which normally would take up a lot of their day-to-day activities and keeping things going and, you know, zhuzhing things up on the website or putting ads out there, we force them into like a room and then we have like a full on, you know, full day or 2 days of just brainstorming or talking or like working with, okay, we need all this stuff to be edited. We need to like curate the page. We need to do this. So can we all do it together on a single conference table? And what you're doing is you're essentially emulating that whole sort of, you know, college feeling when like a project, everybody met at the conference room and sat on the table and didn't get up till the project was done. I think that's the part that I think is the most, has been the most sort of exciting, but value adding, if I could say, as a team leader, when you are trying to like do product launch successfully or, you know, plan for something.
Yeah, I think that's so critical, especially at the beginning of a project or when you're doing like a midway point of a project. And I think this is where a lot of companies that are debating between whether you should go fully remote or office also don't comprehend is that it doesn't necessarily matter if you're fully remote or fully in an office. If you don't have that space for your team to get together and sit down and brainstorm together, you can have everybody come in 5 days a week and still not have that cohesiveness as a remote team that comes together maybe once a month or once every 45 to 90 days. And they're sitting in a room for 2 to 3 days straight to get something, you know, banged out the door. So yeah, I agree that that's a great way to create a vacuum.
Yeah, and also changes things up a bit in terms of the rhythm. It makes things a little exciting because you have this like new and innovative sort of time that you've not had to like actually change gears and put your mind in a different space.
So let's talk about your prototyping process. Like, where are you currently? Because you said you have a vision, but you're launching out different prototypes to get to that vision. How close are you to that vision? And can we also see the product?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because you have it in your head.
So I've got, actually, prototyping is a great topic. I've got a bunch of stuff, so I can give you guys a little 101 on Iwer, since I know it's not the hottest topic. But prototyping for us has been really helpful, and it comes back to like the college that we went to, which had such a heavy focus on prototyping. And for me, who someone who loves building things with their hands, you know, whether it's digital, physical, it really doesn't matter. Building something is the fun part, and I think an environment that exercises that and, you know, encourages that is where at least I thrive. And I think to make really great products, you need to have that sort of freedom to just create great prototypes. So Iwer is really interesting, and I'll start with just the pair of Stoggles. But yeah, these are a pair of Stoggles, and
very stylish.
If you know, they have these like unique side shields and top shields, which is not unique to a pair of Iwer because mountaineering glasses have had side shields. They're just that those are opaque to like block the wind.
Yeah.
We had to do a little bit more engineering to get these to be clear so that you don't have sort of tunnel vision. And our eyes are one of the most like incredibly expressive things ever. So we're so tuned to like how our eyebrows and eyes move that what we're doing when we create Iwer is sort of elevating certain curves that we want to showcase that make someone look stylish, angry, sad, cool, laid back, etc. And all those curves matter. And so when you're dealing with curves of such minute curvature and angles, you can't do it through just sketches. You have to get digital. You have to get, you know, go 3D. And so one of the great things was that in both of us, I think, we had a great command over three-dimensional softwares to be able to quickly replicate what we were thinking onto an actual idea. And then you're just looking at a screen and just being like, ooh, that pair looks really cool. I wonder if we can make it a little stylish and have the eyebrows go up, you know? And you're just changing things around, which is a lot of fun. But then that's just the look of it. there's a whole different component, which is the comfort of it. And I think that's where a lot of safety eyewear just got it wrong, because they were just so focused on the look that they totally disregarded, you know, the fit and the, you know, the comfort of it. We would 3D print our glasses, and sometimes each like shape, like for example, our rectangle, we went to 38 different versions of the prototypes.
So oh, wow.
You had 38 different versions, all pretty much the same sort of like outline and, you know, stylish like sort of feature. But from the comfort, it was a whole different amount of changes. And so that part of like 3D printing and actually testing him on and different heads was like sort of our golden rule to like getting successful eyewear that was both good looking and sort of, you know, comfortable and fashionable.
Do you have just one size fits all, or do you have different shapes and sizes?
Yeah, so great question. Initially, we just launched with just two shapes. It was just the square and the round. I don't have the square, but the round is here. The round and square are the most common shapes for most people. There's like 90% of people who can do with a regular sort of fit, and then there's the 10% that need something a little bit, you know, different or like wider or, you know, taller, etc. So what we did was when we launched, we just launched with a simple offering, one shape fits all. But today, now we're investing more into like all the outliers. Hey, my head's too wide. I can't wear a pair of goggles. You know, now it's our mission to sort of grow that sort of product set to appeal to more customers, including prescription 101 on eyewear. So when we first started, we started with these flat classic glasses. And these are basically glass. They're super flat. That's where eyewear first began. Sometime during the 80s, we moved to these like curved glasses. Okay. And this was like pioneered by like performance because, you know, everybody, I guess, wanted to look like Lance Armstrong on the back of their bike. But,
that's what I was literally thinking.
Yeah, exactly. And so it worked, but it worked for a while. And after a while, then it starts to look very dated, you know. I could just wear and doesn't have the right vibe, especially when you're considering.
So you're going fishing.
Yeah, exactly. Especially when you're considering like, hey, this has to suit men and women. And most of eyewear was designed, you know, just keeping men in mind. And so what we did was we tried to have like a sort of a crossover, which is where eyewear is headed today, which is something that's classic from the front, but has a little bit of curvature, you know, from the top, as you can see. So it does a little bit of both. And I think that's what a pair of goggles does really well. Kind of does a little bit of both. But I think the biggest difference is the fact that most safety eyewear still comes like this, which is extremely hard or almost impossible to put a prescription lens into. Because we've kept things predominantly flat and the lenses are their own independent lenses and not one lens, you know, wrapping, we're able to actually do prescription just like a regular pair of glasses would. And so for everybody that has struggled to have safety glasses and have prescription, we've become like this revolutionary product that has changed that. So prescription for us is like a huge component just because there's no other competitor on the market that is able to, you know, do the sort of product and, you know, fit the sort of prescription that we've done on our form factor.
Yeah, wow. So that is your differentiating point amongst all your competitors.
Completely. 100%. Especially really big competitors like 3M who have stuck this and, you know, they still sell this just because it is a price sensitive product. It's a lot cheaper to make versus we're going the D2C route. And we're like saying that if you really care about protection, you get these yourself. You won't need an employer to buy that for you. I know it's like an uphill battle and like the road is pretty long because, you know, 80% or I would say like maybe 75% of safety eyewear is driven through, you know, employers buying it for employees.
Sure.
And so got that little hump to get over. But I think we got to start somewhere. And if we start soon, then we can get there.
That's awesome. Yeah. And for those, for anyone who's listening through Spotify and not seeing the YouTube, those glasses, they look like they're Gucci or Balenciaga. They look really stylish.
Appreciate that.
As a multidisciplinary designer, how do you balance creativity and wanting to come up with developing new products versus refining what you currently have?
Oh, that's a great question. creative work, I mean, I'm a designer and my business partner is too, Max. And so both of us are creative, and much of our duties today are just we spend a lot of time just like organizing and curating. Just being creative and finding your times where you can be creative is super important. It's like, how do we stay our like creative juices going, but at the same time keep this company running? And then, if we figure that out between us, then we're able to understand where exactly this creativity gonna have most value. And so we sort of like apply a very sort of data-driven approach where like, is new product gonna drive more, and how much effort is that gonna take, versus these are all the kinks, or chinks within our armor on our existing product. What do we need to do here to like stabilize this so that this has more longevity as like a product line and would still sort of drive value for us?
Yeah, I love what you said, which is, where is the creativity going to add the most value? Because a lot of organizations, they just, they don't necessarily know where to point their team's creativity. It's just like, we need more creative thinkers. We need creative, we need this, we need that. But why and for what efforts are you going to need that creativity for? And I think you just summarized it so well, which is figure out where it's needed and then focus that, because certain areas of the business or certain processes just need repetitiveness and refinement. Mm-hmm. Doesn't need the creativity. Like, don't fix what's not broken.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. But be mindful of your team, because you have to balance them doing new stuff and you have to balance them just like fixing stuff. And so don't burn on either side too much, where they're only fixing stuff, and then when you want them to do new stuff, they're like, hey, I don't even know if I have the confidence to go for it, or vice versa, where they're like so focused on new that they are not like spending time refining. And that requires a different sort of mindset and discipline. And so it's up to a team leader, again, co-founder, to like bring that balance to your team members.
Yeah. And that's the most important part, is to be able to enjoy what you're doing too.
100%. I think you don't stand a chance if you don't enjoy it, because somebody else is enjoying it like crazy and is going to beat you.
Yeah.
It's really, it's about feeding off of those passionate people and basically fueling yourself to do it for you.
Exactly. And that's where your competitors can swoop right in, is if you're not passionate, you're probably putting in the bare minimum, you're dragging your feet, and things take a little bit longer than they need to. Whereas if you're passionate, that's your entire life. You go to sleep thinking about it, you wake up thinking about it, and you're just in the grind and you're enjoying every bit of that process. And that's what's going to get you ahead.
Yeah.
You have to be passionate about what you're doing.
Yeah. It's the stuff that is going to get you through the grunt work. Otherwise, you like put up your hands when it comes to like all the not fun stuff.
Exactly. And what other advice do you have for entrepreneurs or startup founders looking to like turn their ideas into a successful business?
Oh man, that's a great one. For us, it happens so organically, so naturally. I think the biggest advice is like, stay lean. I think have expectations, but balance them with realistic sort of, achievements that you can sort of strive to achieve. You have to know your capacity, and throw yourselves around people who have the discipline and experience in getting things off the ground. I think that's the biggest learning we've had, just knowing each other. He leans on me because I have certain experience and confidence in getting something done in a particular way, and I have to lean on him in certain ways. So you're doing that even with, as partners. And I think you need to find people who help you do that.
Exactly. And you don't even know if you're being effective or not. You don't know if you're doing the right, in the right position. So by having people around you, it certainly helps like mirror like where you can improve, even if it's a small increment of improvement.
Yeah. I mean, that's the only way we learn. We learn of seeing other human beings do something.
Exactly. So. Yeah. And how do you stay on top of emerging trends? And consumer demands in design and tech space? And how do you incorporate those insights back to Stoggles?
That's a really good question. And I think fundamentally, it was the reason why we went to design school, or should I say a design school like Art Center, that focused so much on the getting smart phase. And this is something we learned when we were in college. You know, most people will say like, oh, you got to do the research, you know, and research is such a like, oh, I got to do research. But like, nobody tells you like, what is good research? Like, how do you do research? You know, it's just like, oh, go open a bunch of browsers, you know, open a bunch of tabs, you know, fill your mind with something. But like, how do you do it? And I think that's what we learned at Art Center is like, how do you efficiently get smart about a topic? And if you're able to, like, and that's why I think where, like, design methodology is so important. Mm-hmm. Design thinking is so important. It's because of this part is, like, there is a process where you take data and then you diverge, try and do as much as, like, finding as you can. But then there's this very quickly, there's this converging point. And it's all about making those vital connections between your divergent process and your convergent process. Mm-hmm. And I think if you stay with that, sort of connected to that process and apply that every day, then coming up and staying up with trends is easy because you're constantly just adding to a deck that you're already building.
It's almost like getting niche to what you're designing and just gathering more information about that specific niche versus like gathering as much information about consumer brands because it's such a broad topic.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think coming down to those emotions and those feelings, because I think those are the biggest drivers of why we make a decision one way or the other. You know, because on paper, sometimes something can look pretty similar, but it's like, what is that emotional driver? Is that the piece that's going to keep your head above the water?
Yeah. Yeah. And what would you say is, as a designer and as an entrepreneur, like, what is the right amount of research and gathering before you have that convergence?
I think we sometimes when we talk about research, we forget a very important sort of step, which is just framing your research. And this framing process is very important because it's kind of like you set the boundaries of what you're going to research about and what you're going to stay the hell away from. Just because it's going to distract you. It's going to add more, but it's not going to add valuable. Coming up with the framework, focusing on that those constraints, and then designing within those constraints. And it takes me back again to Art Center, where like there was one exercise we did, which was about future methodologies. And it was a very interesting exercise where some things that we would obviously have planned for even today was you have these four quadrants, and in each quadrant, you're basically creating a reality. And so one of the realities, as an example, would be like, California is in this insanely drought time, you know, there is just no water. What products in a home would thrive in a reality like that, right? And so you're sort of forcing yourself to create something within that reality that you've defined. You're doing this process, but you're doing this like, you know, automatically in your head. And so for people who don't know it, that's when you got to like ask the right questions, frame your sort of like your research right, then go after it.
I really like that. And I really like that quadrant way of thinking too, the framework where you're taking different extremes and putting your ideal product into different scenarios and gets you to think about it in a different way.
Forces you, because you have this huge control.
Forces you.
Yeah. And that you can't come over.
Yeah.
And I think like our initial discussion, we're so comfortable sometimes we don't want to think in that space. You know, we never want to like put ourselves in uncomfortable situations. But I think we learn more when we do. And right from a kid, you know, I was scared to go into school. I was scared to go here. And every kid has fears. But now looking back, those are the fears that actually built you. So,
yeah.
If I think it takes a lot, but it's something that each of us, like I said, have to deal with and strive for.
Yeah, and it's different because, you know, you hear a lot of people, thought leaders saying, oh, you know, don't act based on your fears, you know where you're going and just keep striving for it. But I think there's got to be a right balance because I've also come across a lot of founders who have these crazy ideas, mm-hmm. and it, you know, they're living in their own reality of why this product needs to exist, and they can't see it in other ways why like nobody else but them needs it.
Yeah, I'm reminded of a TED talk that Tim Brown, CEO of IDEO, ran. I think it was Tales of Creativity or something. Super influential TED talk. Totally changed the way I sort of approach things. But he sort of humanizes the sort of role playing and like all these really like kiddish things that as a child, like just the other day, I saw a kid walk past and it is amazing how much eye contact she had locked onto me. And it is like, I had to break away from her because she was so curious. And I was like, you would never have that with an adult. You know, if you did, it'd be like, okay, something really happened there. You know, that, you know, but you know, as kids, we're like so curious to wanting to know more about something that as we get older, we sort of try to diminish. And when we go to school and, you know, peer pressure, it all like chips away at our confidence. And he sort of talks about bringing that sort of energy and that sort of like playfulness and like, don't care who, just like test it out, just like say what you want.
Yeah,
how do you create that environment? It's so hard as adults, you know. And I think it requires a great leader to like to do it himself or herself to be able to like showcase how it's like the confidence that you need to actually be in that sort of vulnerable space. And I think even with personal relationships, we like that. We gravitate to people who can be more vulnerable, you know?
Gosh, you have so many good talking points, by the way. Every time you say something, I'm like, oh, I gotta jump on this. So the eye contact thing, and then we'll talk about the thinking like a child, because I think those are really great points. And we're digressing a little bit from tech and innovation, but I think this part is so important.
It's hugely important for innovation.
Tech and innovation. Yeah, because it all comes down to mindset. And as you said, it starts with a single leader that's able to inspire other people to think and act in the similar way. But what I was going to share, so the first thing I was going to share is that, we start out as a child and childlike thinking and childlike curiosity and wonder, and society chips away at that. And so a lot of what's going through our heads of like, oh, I can't do this, I can't do that, a lot of our self-doubt doesn't actually come from our own generated thoughts.
No.
They, at some point in your childhood, an adult has told you, oh, you shouldn't do this. You should be ashamed of yourself. Oh, this is embarrassing. You can't do that. There's so many doubts that have been stuck in our heads from what other people have told us, and it just replays. So those aren't actually our own thoughts. Those are other things that have somehow got into our subconsciousness.
That's it. That's exactly
So the more you take those negative thoughts out of your head, the more you're able to go back to that early childlike curiosity and wonder.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And the answer, it's really interesting, is love. That's why parents love their kids as much as they can, because you have no control who they're going to meet. And then that person's going to be like, you shouldn't do this. Whoever told you should do this. Can you imagine how powerful a moment that is for a kid who their parents have never been like that, but someone, a stranger, has that sort of impact on them? They're going to remember that for the rest of their life, no matter what their parents do after. And so all that you can do is just love yourself. But balance, like love yourself to a point where like, you know, you feel grateful and you feel worthy, but don't love yourself so much that you're over the top and you're like, okay. But it keeps coming down to balance. And I think, you know, being a child and like, because we've been on one side of the spectrum so much, this is one way of bringing back the balance where you have to spend more time in child mode.
I actually try to meditate in that of like, what is it like to think like a child and just kind of sit in silence and like go back into like, well, what did 6-year-old Jenny, if I was 6 years old, like what would I want to do right now? And I certainly do not want to be on a Zoom meeting, that's for sure. Like I just want to go and play music and like run around. But you know, it's just that exercise in itself of like going back and like being able to think like that's so powerful. Even if it's for 10 minutes a day,
Hugely impactful. But and that's why environments are so important. I think great founders and great leaders, product leaders, whatever you want to call them, they try to create those environments where you feel like fun. This is fun.
Yeah.
We're not like funny. Yeah. We're like serious fun, but we have fun.
Exactly. You have to have fun in what you do because you're spending majority of your time working. And like, I don't know, that whole putting a ping pong table at an office, that's not fun. That is not actually fun. That's a distraction, FYI, for anyone who wants to come at me and say ping pong tables are fun. They are not fun. one last thing I want to share, because you were saying about how the kid was like locked in with your eye contact.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to share this with the audience is I actually started doing that on purpose.
Nice. All right, I gotta run into you, Jenny.
Yeah. So any person, especially because I live in downtown where there's a lot of people coming by, so there's not a lot of opportunities for me to practice. It's so uncomfortable because you're like, oh my God, I don't want to, lock eye contact with a stranger, especially if it's a man. I don't want him to think that I'm giving him wrong vibes. But it's fascinating. Like the amount of positive reactions I've received. In my head, I thought like, okay, if I lock eyes with people, they're going to think I'm such a creep and that like, you know, they're going to think all these weird things about me. What actually has been happening, and I've been doing this for about maybe 5 months now.
Nice.
Whoa. Every day, whoever's passing by, just set eye contact.
Nice.
Just lock it in until they look away first or they, you know, do something else. I will almost always get a smile or, hey, how's it going? Or just like, it lightens up their day. You can see it in their face of like, oh my God, this person sees me. And like, just seeing their reaction brings so much joy to my everyday life living here in downtown LA.
Yeah.
And I wanted to also ask you about Luxottica. I think it's called Luxottica.
Yeah, Luxottica. Huge.
Yeah. Yeah. If that's like ever in your roadmap to sell.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Luxottica would be the best exit we could imagine. It's just they acquire brands that are super established. I'll give you one very simple example. I won't go to Ray-Ban because that was many, many years before, but Oakley and Oliver Peoples. Oliver Peoples was acquired by Oakley, and then Luxottica pushed Oakley into an acquisition, into acquiring both brands for a price that they want. It's amazing how many brands are under their sort of umbrella.
They own like what, like 90%, 99%?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Because they've also like worked with a lot of fashion labels, and their like whole model is very, very interesting. They invested so much onto the manufacturing front that they were like, why do any of these or brands would ever need to manufacture their own product?
And so they
went to every single large Italian, French designer brand and said, we'll do it for you. And they had they're in their Rolodex, they had a whole bunch of brands that they were already working with because they're Italian. And so we have this like, we care about quality, but we're also like the China of the West where we can manufacture anything.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great combination where like anybody, any company, it's going to take a lot more for them to like take on Luxottica. I would say most successful would be Warby Parker. But that's, again, only in the United States.
Yeah, they're so small. Yeah.
Small in compared to Luxottica. So.
Yeah. I mean, talk about a monopoly. My goodness. Like, they have a really fascinating way of, like, expanding. I can't think of any other company that just dominates a single industry like that.
Yeah.
And most people don't even know Luxottica. They're like, oh, yeah, like, I got these Chanel glasses. No, it's manufactured by the same company as the $2 sunglasses I'm holding up, you know? Like
exactly. And they're so, like you said it, like they're a monopoly. Sunglasses Hut is their own store. And that's why you have a Sunglasses Hut.
I didn't know that.
If you go to Dubai, you get a Sunglasses Hut. If you go to Los Angeles, you have a Sunglasses Hut. You can go to India and get a Sunglasses Hut too. They are everywhere. And so when that happens, then it's almost impossible for any retailer to like set up their own store if you have one hut that you're calling hut that has all these amazing brands all under one roof. Yeah, huge monopoly.
Yeah.
Just yeah, they struck their chord when it was right and built an empire.
So we're coming up on time, so I want to ask you one last question. Yeah. What's next for Stoggles, and how do you plan to continue to innovate and push boundaries for protective eyewear design?
Ooh, great question. But I don't want to let too much out of the bag. So I'll try.
Okay. What can you share with us?
As possible. But, you know, I'll come back to the fact that I think we're on a mission to make eyewear protective. And eyewear, I think it's, you know, what we understood about eyewear is that, why do we wear eyewear? Eyewear is supposed to be protective. It's table stakes for eyewear to be protective. It's just that we've taken out the whole fashion issue because it needs to be protective. And what we're trying to do is bring some of that flavor back. Safety eyewear is one way of like looking at it. Maybe that's where we started, but we're essentially becoming a brand that cares about people caring for their eyes, but doing it in a way that makes them feel elevated, happy, special, and just you. And I think, you know, products in this category have failed, or like rather should I say, companies within this category have failed to deliver on that because they've been so hyper-focused on that single component, which is price, or that single component that is that single component that's something else. But it takes a designer or like a design person's approach to like look at things holistically. And I think that's what we've tried to do. And I think that's what we're pitching ourselves up for success for whichever space we enter tomorrow, because there are a bunch of them. But, you know, I won't beat around the bush, but sunglasses is the biggest. And we feel if we can create a product that, you know, complements both these categories, that we will find a customer within that. And have our Stoggles story yet again.
I love that, because what you're saying is that you're essentially going after building a brand that people can resonate and love, as opposed to competing with a single variable like price.
Exactly. And that's why our motto is like style, safety first, style also first. And then our tagline is love your eyes. So we're coming at it from a very different sort of space and taking a customer to a totally different mind space about a product versus, you know, everybody else that's done it differently.
Yeah, I love that. And if anyone wants to reach out to you, what's the best way that they can contact you?
LinkedIn's great because I think we all sort of are able to not only, you know, reach out to people, but also see if we align with, you know, their professional experience or where they're headed. Otherwise, come visit us at our store on at stoggles.com and say hi.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Raul.
Thank you, Jenny. Pleasure.